year 1820, former President Thomas Jefferson was 77 and debuted a document that he'd been working on that became known as Jefferson's Bible. It was later in his life, in the last decade of his life, and for several years he had been at work, literally with a penknife, carving out passages from translations of the Gospels in English. So he proposed what he saw as the definitive text, the definitive gospel of Christ's life. There's some ways in which it was kind of a pious project. It was very drawn to the teaching of Christ, his moral vision, but there were some obvious downfalls and some tragic flaws to the final product. For one, his document was very, very short. Only one gospel as opposed to four. So he had to condense a great deal. One of the things that he overlooked completely was the miracles. He thought that they were of dubious origin, and he thought that they were secondary anyway to the moral code that Christ proclaimed. So no miracles. In the Gospels, miracles are everywhere. He also had a really abrupt ending. He ended with Christ's death. He didn't say anything about the resurrection, which if you're reading the Gospels, it's kind of the point that Christ leaves the tomb on Easter Sunday. So it's a very different story than what one would recognize. And it's not a temptation that only Thomas Jefferson fell prey to, or falls prey to, in the history of the church. It's a bit of a constant temptation in a way throughout Christianity to be tempted to rewrite or recast the Gospels in our own image and likeness, according to our own preferences. It's a temptation that even today we have to be careful of. The word heresy is a word we typically shine back on the early stages of the church's life. It comes from a Greek word, heresio, that means to choose or to select. What happens in heresy then is that one is choosing a particular piece of the gospel that's carved out or a truth of the teaching of the church and leveraging it against the entirety of the gospels or the teaching of the church. It's an easy temptation to fall into, but it falls short of the meaning of the whole, which is very much a Catholic sensibility, reference to the whole. That's what Catholic means from the Greek roots, kata holos, according to the whole. It means that as Catholics, there's an invitation and a challenge to live and to believe according to the whole, according to the entirety of a universal church, not just a local one, and according to the entirety of the Gospels, the teaching of the church. It's okay to have favorite passages of Scripture, I would say. In fact, it's a really good thing, even necessary. But to leverage a passage against the entirety of the gospel message would mean going astray, certainly. Another temptation that we can easily fall into, which Jefferson did as well, was to think of Christ as a really admirable moral teacher. Is there a moral impetus behind his message? Absolutely. But that if that's his only identity, we're pretty badly missing the point of who Christ is and what his life means. A couple of great lines from C.S. Lewis that drive us home really well. He says it better than I could, so I'll just share this. He's pointing to the fact that no one who knew Christ in his earthly life thought of him in this way as just a moral teacher. We may note in passing that he, Christ, was never regarded as a mere moral teacher. He did not produce that effect on any of the people who actually met him. He produced mainly three effects: hatred, terror, adoration. There was no trace of anyone expressing mild approval. Which is pretty eye-opening. It's a temptation that we have today. Mild approval. Wasn't it nice what Jesus said or did, and kind of leave it at that? Something deeper is at work in his life. And extremely bold and powerful gospels like this have a way of driving that point. We hear these words, I suspect none of us don't feel a bit challenged by what Christ says in the gospel today from Luke chapter 14. And most troubling for many of us is probably the first sentence that uses the word hate relative to members of one's family. There might be a Jeffersonian impulse to cut that passage out of the gospel and say, do without that sentence, just leave it in a void. But the truth is that it belongs according to the whole, and there must be a deeper meaning that we can come to understand and cling to in our own lives. The word that's used in Hebrew and Greek for hate is a bit nuanced from the English way that we understand it. It means a comparison to the virtue of love. So the it's kind of a word that takes on its meaning relative to the word love. So the sense in English is, whoever comes to me without loving, family, father, mother, sister, brother, wife, children, less than me, cannot be my disciple. There's a passage just like this in Matthew's Gospel. That's consistent with what it says. But it's still a great challenge, even to understand the words this way. Whoever comes to me loving less, these people cannot be my disciple. Part of the reason I think we can understand these words in a more healthy way would be to appreciate, it says at the beginning of the Gospel, the first words, that a great crowd is listening to Christ, not just a small group of people. What happens anytime there's a great crowd present? There are many motivations, many perspectives, many beliefs. And one way that Christ is drawing the conversation is to move his listeners from having many motivations to follow him to having one. Why is this important? We go a little later in the Gospels, think for a moment of Holy Week. Palm Sunday, when Christ enters Jerusalem for Passover, the final days of his life, there's a great crowd that appears. And on the surface, they're all would-be supporters, as far as we know. They seem to be following, cheering him on. Palm Sunday is a very jubilant occasion. But they have many motivations. Some are ardent followers. Some are suspicious of what Christ says. Some are curious. They just want to hear him speak. They think maybe there will be a miracle. And we also know that some of them are plotting put Christ to death. So as Holy Week unfolds, the crowd of supporters of Jesus begins to win, until finally, at his death, many of the followers have gone, even the disciples. Only a few remain, and those few do not have many motivations for following Christ. They only have one. They want to be as near to God as they can, whatever happens. It's that motivation alone that allows one to stay with him throughout the events of his passion and his death. There's a bit of a question that the crowd must be thinking when they hear these words of Christ. He's talking about discipleship. And I suspect many, if not all of them, are asking themselves, what will this cost me, following Christ the way that he suggests? What will it cost? It's a question we ask every day in life, in some way or another. What does it cost? This question we can place before Christ himself too and say, what will it cost him, the mission he's taken up in the world? We know the answer. It will cost him everything. It will cost him his life. It's a beautiful passage, the previous chapter, Luke 13, where Christ relates his lament over Jerusalem. Beautiful words, kind of heartbreaking too. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets, stone those sent to you. How I have longed to gather your children as a hen gathers her brood beneath her wings, but you were unwilling. It's heartbreaking, but there's this maternal kindness of Christ, this desire to continue to express his love for the Father and to express his love for us. This is the thing that keeps him going. And in the Christian life, we might ask ourselves too, what keeps me going? There's a lot of challenges. Every day can be difficult to see the men and women God calls us to be. Why do we continue? The Christian life allows us to express our love for God and to express our love for one another. It's wrong to think that these words, though harsh, that we hear today, overturn the law of charity that's present in the Gospels. In a way, they're underscoring the real meaning of charity and what it means to love. In the end, I think the implication is this. We love best when we love God first and foremost, and we love others in God. We love best when we love God first and foremost, and we love others in God. And if we take Christ at his word, it's not only the best way to love, but it may be the